This evening on The Rock Newman Show, Dr. Renoko Rashidi is an author, an anthropologist, scholar, and historian whose work focuses on the African world. He's led many tours around the world, exposing African Americans and Africans of the diaspora to histories going back to ancient Egypt and the African experience worldwide. We'll talk with Dr. Rashidi about his incredible experience, discoveries, and much more. That's coming up right now on The Rock Newman Show. Welcome to The Rock Newman Show from the campus of historic Howard University right here in the nation's capital. I'm Rock Newman, and it is my desire to inspire you with personal stories of extraordinary achievement. Dr. Renoko Rashidi follows in the footsteps of legendary historians like Dr. Henrik Clark, Dr. Yosef Ben Yochanan, Chancellor Williams, and Dr. Ivan Van Sertimer, pioneering historians whose work focused on Africa and the African diaspora. Renoko Rashidi is the author of several books and lectures extensively on Africa's presence and hidden histories around the world. Thank you, brother, for showing up today.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. I'm glad to be here.
You know, when one Googles Renoko Rashidi, you find many things. There are 10 quotes that 10 famous quotes by Renoko Rashidi. And I'm going to ask my control room and the audience to indulge me while I read one of them. It is number 5 of the 10. It's somewhat lengthy, but I'll try to get through it quickly for you. But please listen up. There is no question that Africa is the mother continent. It is the birthplace of modern humanity. If we did not know it before, the genetic studies of the past 30 years have surely confirmed this. Of course, a lot of people, even black people, find this impossible to accept. And I think the reason for this is our bias against Africa. We are taught systematically from the beginning to be anti-African. And I have found this to be the case even in Africa. So many of us would prefer to think of ourselves as anything but African. Even myself as a youth, because my mother's mother was Cherokee, I thought of myself as a Native American. Yes, even me, but as I grew and learned about Africa and studied Africa, my pride in my African identity soared like an eagle. So today when I hear our people say that they are not African, I don't get angry with them. I feel sorry for them and pray that one day they cease to be content with the food of chickens and see themselves as the mighty eagles they truly are. We are African people. Get comfortable with it and learn to love your African self. Whew! Renoko Rashidi, that is a mouthful. Tell us the impetus for your feeling the need to put that out as one of your significant quotes.
I want us to be a powerful people again. And in order to be powerful, we have to reach out to Africa, and Africa has to reach out to us. I think that Africans in America, African Americans, are in perhaps the most advantageous position of any group of black folk in the world. We have more wealth than most of the African people do. And in spite of everything, we have a level of freedom of speech and movement that a lot of other African people don't. So it's ironic to me that the descendants of people taken out of the door of no return are now in such a pivotal position to shape and mold the future of Africa and the entire African world.
Let's, I want to stay kind of basic here.
All right.
fundamental. You said Africa is the birthplace
of humanity and civilization.
Of humanity and civilization. Mm-hmm. So here's what I'd like for you to do as a professor.
Okay.
I would like for you to validate and justify that statement.
Well, I think we've known that Africa is the birthplace of humanity for a very long time, going back to at least the time of the 1930s with the discoveries by the Leakey family. And then with DNA analysis, it confirmed it. In the 1980s in particular, you have these studies of mitochondrial DNA that conclude that there's really an African woman who's the mother of all humanity. And those ancient Africans begin to go out and people the rest of the world and morphed into the other so-called races today. There's only one race, and that's the human race, mm-hmm. which is born in Africa. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, one of my great teachers, Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, used to say, Renoko, it's one thing to say that you were first. It's another thing to say what you did. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about what we did, I think what we can focus mostly on is Nile Valley civilization. Now, that's not everything. Mm-hmm. For example, I do lots of lectures in 67 countries now, in front of all kind of folk. And a lot of times, just to break the ice, I ask people, what do you think of when you think of Africa? And I get a lot of answers, but three never fail. One is wild animals. Number two, disease. And the third one is poverty and disease. Mm. So I begin to say, you know, Africa is where the first people came from. And Africa is where people first stood on 2 feet. And Africa is where people first domesticated fire and had art and music and buried the dead and had mathematics and charted the stars in the heavens and built a house and wore clothes and wore shoes and sailed a boat and had mathematics and had science, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see Africa as the basis of human culture. But when it comes to classical civilization, nothing compares with Nile Valley civilization. It lasted longer than the Greeks and the Romans put together, and it is quintessentially African. So you needn't look no further than that. The evidence is there. I think the problem is we have been so programmed to be anti-African that in spite of our knowledge of these things, there's a tendency to want to reject Africa anyway. Because Tarzan is very powerful. King Kong is very powerful. When I was growing up, that was my image of Africa, of a native running through the jungle.
Absolutely.
With his spear, with a big afro and a bone in his nose, yelling ooga booga, yeah. Looking for a Christian missionary for dinner. Mm-hmm. And so in spite of all the things that I've learned to counter that, that image is still deeply buried in our psyche. Mm-hmm. And not just mine, but I think everybody's.
So then that speaks to what has been the incredible, perhaps diabolical, but incredible success of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And when I say incredible success, because if what you just state is, as what you obviously call it, a reality about the greatness and the grandeur and the accomplishment and the humanity of the Nile and other areas, mm-hmm. if that is truth, then the whitewashing and the diminution of that truth that is so powerful that would make folks clearly descended from Africa hate Africa. I just think right now about being on a playground. Mm-hmm. And with all the cuss words we knew as kids, I don't know one that was more damaging than to call somebody ABC. And that was Africa's blackest child. So there was a sting. There was a sting to that word that we knew as children, which points directly to what has been the success and the power of white supremacy.
That's true. I thought you were going to say African booty scratcher. and the funniest thing, and one of the saddest things about that, is I've heard people from the continent of Africa refer to other Africans with that same term. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I did a series of programs in Philadelphia, mostly with Nigerian and Liberian students, and I was astonished to hear them use some of that same terminology that I would expect to come from a misinformed African American. Mm-hmm. But yeah, white supremacy has been that powerful, and it is that powerful, and it comes as a result of enslavement and colonization. That changed everything. It changed the power dynamics of the world. It changed the way the world came to see Africa. And sadly, It changed the way Africans came to see themselves. And that is what we are combating now. Physical slavery, for the most part, is over. We hear these reports about Africans being sold in places like Libya, in Africa today. But for the most part, and I'm sure you would agree, the slavery that we are confronting today is a slavery of the mind. And in some ways, it's more difficult to emancipate the mind than it is to emancipate the body.
Which takes me to number three of your famous quotes. We cannot destroy white supremacy until we address the internal contradictions in ourselves and in our communities that allow white supremacy to continue to flourish.
Yeah.
I would like to give you an opportunity to unpack that the way you see fit best to unpack it.
Well, I'll try by using two other quotes by two famous Africans. One is Carter G. Woodson, who lived right here in D.C. And Woodson said, Dr. Woodson said, if you control a man's thinking, you don't have to worry about his actions. And the other one is Stephen Biko, who said, the greatest weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. I don't think you can control a people, as I said, physically, unless you control them psychologically. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, we enable white supremacy. And if all the white people were to leave the planet today, white supremacy would still continue, because we've been so indoctrinated with white supremacist tendencies. There's a brother, a psychologist out on the West Coast, named Dr. Wade Nobles. And Dr. Nobles likes to say that the essence of power is the ability to define someone's reality and make them live according to that definition as though they chose that definition. And so today our standards of beauty, our standards for success, what does it mean to be happy? All of these things are, in many ways, I think, instilled in our minds by a white supremacist culture. And those are the things that we're fighting. So I realized early on, I've been doing this for a long time now, I realized early on that as a historian, that was the way that I could make my most effective contribution towards putting a dagger in the heart of white supremacy. Knowledge of self is so very, very powerful. And we can use so many examples. One of the greatest examples is Malcolm X. Now, you know, Malcolm's parents were Garveyites, mm-hmm. even though Malcolm at some point went astray, though.
Sure.
And he became what he described in his autobiography as a common criminal. Mm-hmm. And he became possessed of knowledge of self, mm-hmm. and he was transformed into our black shining prince.
Yeah.
And we can use one example after another after the other. So knowledge of self is so very powerful, and knowledge of self, I think, starts with Africa. And what makes my work different, I think, than a lot of other people, is that I've been looking at other parts of the African world for a very, very long time, and realized that the African diaspora began long before enslavement. So not only is humanity birthed in Africa, not only did we produce the greatest civilization that the world has ever seen, but African people began to filter out of Africa tens of thousands of years before enslavement. And so that today, some of the largest black population centers in the world are not in the Americas, they're in Asia. You know, of course, you have black people in places like Australia and the Pacific Islands. Mm-hmm. And African people did remarkable things that we need to look at. And then, of course, and I know we're going to get into this, you have the role of African people in classical civilizations in other parts of the world. Even in the Americas, we have the Olmec civilization, the parent civilization of the Western Hemisphere. And clearly, there was an African element there. Mm-hmm. So we have a history, I would say, it's the greatest story that's barely been told. And it's just delightful to me to be a part of the telling of that story.
So, boy, I said to you before.
We're covering a lot.
I said to you before we started, I wish we had 2 or 3 hours for this.
Just to start.
Yes, because here's where I want to go. You just said something. You just said Africans started 10,000 years.
Tens of thousands
of years. Tens of thousands of years. But in the United States and other parts of the world, mm-hmm. people adhere to and are more influenced by the Bible.
Uh-oh.
Than perhaps any other book, any other person, mm-hmm. culture, teaching, or otherwise.
Okay.
And the Bible came into existence some 6,000 years ago. as we know it. And tens of thousands of years ago, folks were building civilizations in Africa. So let me hit you something that might get you hurt when you walk out of our door here. I kind of want to hit the nail between the eyes and talk about Jesus.
All right.
And whether or not, with the studies that you have done, Jesus, as is described in the Judeo-Christian books, did he exist?
You're asking me my opinion or my thought on the historicity of Jesus the Christ?
Both.
Yeah, I might get hit outside, man. Mm-hmm. I would say there's no physical evidence for that. I used to be a consultant at a church in Los Angeles, and the pastor brought in some information that I'll never forget. One Sunday afternoon, he brought in a list of writers, people like Diodorus Siculus and Strabo and others, Josephus, that lived at the time. I mean, these are world-famous writers, mm-hmm. whose books we still have today, who lived at the time that Jesus is supposed to have lived. And none of them wrote about this man. Now, you know, if a man raised Lazarus from the dead, which is to me the most powerful story in the Bible, mm. or walked on the water, or fed the multitude with a few fish and loaves of bread, mm-hmm. somebody would have wrote that down. Somebody would have said, there's a man from Galilee that I heard about, or I saw, and he did these remarkable things. But nobody wrote that down. See, to me, that's based on faith. And I'm the last person to take away a person's faith. Sure. If you want to believe that, it works for me. Mm-hmm. I'm more concerned about what you do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Now, the other day, we had a good talk, and you asked me, I suggested, and you asked me to follow up and send you some photographs. One of the photos I should have sent you is an image of a black Christ. Mm-hmm. with a big afro, mm-hmm. surrounded by all of his disciples with the exception of Judas, mm-hmm. and they're all black with woolly hair.
Yeah.
So you do have imagery of Jesus the Christ, but none of that, to my knowledge, is from the time that he is supposed to have lived. Mm-hmm. Another thing, Christianity is not that old. The biblical story is 6,000 years old. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we leave out too sometimes is the fact that Ethiopia, this country in the Horn of Africa, it's perhaps the oldest Christian nation in the world. There's a debate as to whether Ethiopia or Armenia are the most ancient Christian nations. Mm-hmm. So Christianity in Africa is very, very old. And then if you go back to the Nile Valley, you can find the basis of Christianity. You can find the basis of the Ten Commandments and the Immaculate Conception.
Please
and the
virgin
birth and all of those things. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons that Egypt, we call it Kemet now. That means the black city or the black community, but the world knows it as Egypt of the pharaohs is so important because so much happened there that affects modern humanity and the way we see the world. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a concerted effort to take Egypt out of Africa.
Yeah.
And a lot of us are attempting to combat that. Taking Egypt out of Africa would be like taking Greece and Rome out of Europe. Is African classical civilization at its finest. Mm-hmm. And the Christian story, the roots of virtually every other major story can be found there. And so it's very, very important.
You know, if I might introduce this.
We can talk about anything you want to talk
this,
about.
This experience I had in New York.
Uh-huh.
I recognized the name of a cab driver.
Okay.
As being Egyptian. Mm-hmm. And we had a little conversation, it was fun. And I said to him as he was slowing down, I was getting my money to pay him. I said, I hope the next time I come here, my African brother will pick me up. Mm-hmm. And he damn near lost his mind. He said, I am not African. Mm. I am from Egypt. I am Egyptian. Mm-hmm. And I got out the car and I felt a sense of depression. He was so absolutely adamant and offended that I had called him an African And once again, I thought, the extraordinary pervasive power of white supremacy.
Well, I would say a couple things. That would be like comparing the president of the United States today with a Mayan or an Aztec. You're both Americans, but very different kinds of Americans. Now, most of the people, at least a significant portion of the people live in Egypt today, are not the original Egyptians. Their ancestors were not around when those pyramids were being constructed. Mm-hmm. They're the descendants of Arab invaders of North Africa. Now, I've been to Egypt many times. I take groups to Egypt.
Right.
And it never fails when I'm in Egypt, if a person, a well-meaning person, like the taxi driver, comes up to me and says, well, Dr. Rashidi, since you're in Egypt, you might as well go to Africa. As though Egypt and Africa are separated.
Yeah.
The official name for Egypt today is the United Arab Republic. Mm-hmm. And so while Egypt is in Africa and has always been in Africa, most of the people who are there today are not African mm-hmm. and don't see themselves as African. They are mm-hmm. the descendants of invaders, in much the same way as those white folks in South Africa who are now claiming to be Africans are the descendants of invaders. Mm-hmm. There's an expression, I think Kwame Nkrumah says it, you're not an African because you're born in Africa. You're an African because Africa is born in you. And just because you're born in Africa doesn't make you an African. And this is one of the problems that Africa confronts today. Mm-hmm. We have the Chinese in Africa now. You have huge East Indian populations in Africa. And even though there are a lot of black people in India, most of the people who are from India who are in Africa today don't identify with it. You have the descendants of the Boers, the Afrikaners, the Dutch, and Germans in Southern Africa. And most of Northern Africa, including Egypt, I would call a settler colony. Mm-hmm. You could find the same thing if you went to Libya or Tunisia or Algeria or Morocco or Egypt. Mm-hmm. And it's a problem that Africa is going to have to reconcile. Everybody who is in Africa is not an African.
Okay, so studying Africa, the civilization that you talked about tens of thousands of years mm-hmm. earlier, and again, its greatness, its grandness, its introduction of humanity, mm-hmm. Its introduction of civilization, mm-hmm. the strength that was required, the wisdom, the education that was required. All of those things lifted up humanity, mm-hmm. created civilizations. So can you help us and help the audience understand how that greatness came to crumble and to be defeated? Mm.
Well, before we get to the fall, we need to point out that ancient Nile Valley civilization, we're talking about Egypt, we're talking about Kush, we're talking about Mero, we're talking about a number of civilizations in the Nile Valley, of which Egypt was the most spectacular. First, it lasted for thousands of thousands of years. And so in addition to talking about how it crumbled, we also should talk about what made it last for so long. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, in fact, if I were to point to anything that constitutes or was the basis for the longevity of ancient Egyptian civilization, I would say was the family structure. Incredibly close family bond. Mother and husband and wife, mothers and sons, very extraordinary, mm-hmm. okay? And I think that over a period of time, Egyptian civilization, it just got old. I know that may be simplifying it, but it got old.
Let me ask you a question as you talk about the family structure. Mm-hmm. Because when one talks about Osiris and Horus, mm-hmm. so is it your sense, have you found in your research that Holy Trinity had an impact on the family life that you're talking about?
I think it kind of personified it. Now the family trinity that we're talking about in this case is Osiris, Isis and Horus, Asar, Aset, and Heru. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very powerful. It's the most powerful story, in my opinion, ever told. And it is the basis of so much of modern Christianity. And the heroic figure in the story, more than anybody, as I said, is Isis. She's the one that brought Osiris, I saw her back from the dead. Mm-hmm. She's the one who raised the child. She's the central figure in the Immaculate Conception. According to tradition, she's the one who introduced the wedding ring. She introduced mm-hmm. the concept of domesticity. Mm-hmm. So this also tells us that the role of the woman in ancient African society was very powerful, mm-hmm. very different than today. The worst thing you could do in ancient African society was disrespect your mother.
Yeah.
So there are so many things we can learn from ancient Africa. Mm-hmm. But also, there were many holy trinities. That's mm-hmm. the most famous one.
Yeah.
But you have the Trinity of Amen, mm-hmm. from which we derive, we think in the Judaic Christian tradition, the expression Amen.
Amen. Mm-hmm.
He marries a woman named Mut, and we get from the word Mut, M-U-T, the word mother. Mm-hmm. They have a child named Khonsu. Mm-hmm. You have another Holy Trinity with a man named, or the aspect of God created with associated with the intellect, a man named Ptah, who marries a woman named Sekhmet, the mm-hmm. protector. Mm-hmm. She's identified as a woman with the head of a lion, it's fierce.
Yeah.
And they have a child. And so it's interesting that in addition to the most famous trinity of Osiris, Isis, and Horus, you have a number of trinities. So all of these things are very ancient in Africa. And this is one of the reasons I think it's so important that we reconnect Egypt with Africa. Because Egypt is now, in the eyes of most people in the Near East or Middle East or something like that, somebody said the other day that when you want to make a movie about slaves, you get black folk. When you want to make a movie about ancient Egypt, you get white folks.
Yeah.
So the media, as you know, is very, very powerful. And yeah. that's where this notion that ancient Egypt was white continues to be perpetuated in our minds.
When I hear you talk about the role of Isis, mm-hmm. the imagery and the symbolism, and the power from that symbolism that perhaps the most cherished of all in a society is the woman.
Yeah.
And that black woman in Egypt that we're talking about. It makes me think about children in elementary school and junior high school and high school today, that if, and I'm talking about black kids, if they did understand mm. the history, would we ever be celebrating a Lil Wayne? You know, would the difference between, I think you can draw this connection, is that if we understood ourselves, the overwhelming amount of self-destructive behavior in the communities in which we live could be wiped out.
It would change everything. Knowledge of self would change everything. And we should say, to the first point that you alluded to, that the African woman is the mother of humanity and civilization.
Yeah.
I love black women, mm-hmm. and not just because I'm a black man,
yeah.
but because black women have played such a pivotal role in world history. And it's a story that needs to be told. And I think if we as black men talked about that more, the status of black women in modern society would be elevated. I think it's a very, very powerful statement.
Yeah.
And of course, knowledge of self would change everything. If we knew that we came from kings and queens, of course, your attitude would be fundamentally different. We'd stop using the N-word. We'd stop using the B-word. It would just change everything. And so developing a sense of knowledge of self, in my opinion, should be seen as a sacred mission.
Yes, yes.
And we cannot put enough emphasis on it. Malcolm X said it again.
Yes.
Of all our studies, it is history that is most qualified to reward our research. And I fundamentally believe that.
Yes. Okay. So you talked about, because I had started out talking about how the great civilization mm-hmm. was diminished and conquered. I want to go back there because I think, I certainly don't want to glorify the hunters. And those who came to conquer.
Yeah.
But I would like to talk to you about and have you to share your thoughts and your research about how it happened that people started to believe. First of all, the actual on the ground struggles where a land of greatness became conquered. And then I want to talk about what happened after the conquering took place. Mm-hmm. So where were the war? How was it that those from Rome came in and was able to slay the mighty civilizations?
Well, as I say, simply put, and I've never said this before, I think
we're breaking news on the Rock Newman Show.
That it got old, man. That it got old. But I think if we wanted to
add
to that.
What do you mean by that?
No, we're talking about thousands of years of civilization. Mm-hmm. And I think you can reach a point where you cease to grow. Mm-hmm. And you cease to evolve. And when you cease to grow, when you cease to evolve, you begin to die. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a key point. Mm-hmm. But I think that we were also
dying a spiritual death, a psychological death, a physical death.
I think a physical death, uh-huh, to a large extent. Mm-hmm. But I think, too, that we were confronted by a very different civilization, mm-hmm, a very different culture. Those Africans who left Africa tens of thousands of years ago, some of them went into Europe. And they got caught up in that ice. There's only one race, and that's the human race.
Yeah.
But there are many subdivisions within that human race. And then some of those Africans got caught up in that ice and were transformed not just physically, but psychologically. And that was the person that we ultimately confronted. That was the Roman that you're talking about, mm-hmm, who was harder than the African, who was, mm-hmm, far more ruthless, mm-hmm, who was more desperate. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is what led to the subjugation of Africa. And that's the issue that we are confronting today. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the worst things that happens in this country, obviously, is when a black man, a youth, is shot in the street with your hands up in the air begging, don't shoot, unarmed.
Yeah, can't breathe.
And it happens, so many variations of it, and women too.
Yeah.
And we are outraged as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And we can't figure out how that could happen. Why? People could be so cruel. In Senegal, you have a dungeon there that's a dungeon for children. I've seen it. I've been in it. It's called an infant's dungeon. Mm. And this is an infant's dungeon.
Infant dungeon. Mm-hmm.
Now, who would be cruel enough to enslave a child? I think that in spite of everything, you remember Rodney King.
Yes.
Rodney King was beaten.
Sure. Yeah.
When he finally did a press conference, he said, can we all just get along?
Why can't we all get along?
When those people were killed in that church in South Carolina in Charleston, mm-hmm, President Obama, the consoler in chief, mm-hmm, came down there and started singing that song, Amazing Grace. Mm-hmm. I started singing that song too.
Yeah.
Some of those Africans were forgiving that guy, yeah, that neo-Nazi, yeah, before the bodies were buried. Yeah. There is something about the African man and woman that has a level of humanism about them that we don't often find in other cultures. And the Romans didn't have that level of humanism as a result of that. In addition to the crippling effect of old age, that ruthless personality was able to subjugate Africa. And we're still confronted with that today.
You know,
that's why I use those more contemporary examples.
And so, you know, as the scholar who knows a whole lot more than me, but might one equate what happened there with what happened to the natives,
yeah,
here?
Yes. And not just the native here,
yeah,
but the Aboriginal Australians,
yeah,
to people of color all over the world. But those are the two, probably the best examples, maybe the best example of what happened to the Native Americans. They outnumbered the conquistadors. They had a much more ancient civilization, mm-hmm, but the conquistadors had weapons that Native Americans were not used to. Mm-hmm. They had a level of unity, and they had a oneness of purpose. And as a result of that, this age-old civilization of Mayas and Incas and Aztecs crumbled like that.
You know, you mentioned earlier about sending some photos. We got them. I want to see if we can take a look at some of them that you have that you sent over to us. Are we able to do that, control room? Okay, all right. So, and you sent these photos for what purpose? It sounded as if it was something important that you wanted to share, as a result of sending the photos had real meaning. What is that meaning?
Well, pictures are very powerful. Images are very powerful. You know the old expression, seeing is believing, a picture's worth a thousand words. Now we're looking at an Olmec head. The Olmec civilization, as I mentioned earlier, is the parent civilization of the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And there's clearly an African element in the Olmec civilization, as we can see in these massive heads. And there are 20 of these heads. I'm the only person I know that's examined all 20 of them that we know of. Even when Dr. Van Sertima wrote his book, They Came Before Columbus, only 12 or 14 of those heads were known. Mm-hmm. Now we know of 20. And this is not only one of the more powerful looking heads. This is over 3,000 years old, but this is the head with the braids in the back. The one you're looking at right now is called El Rey. That means the king. So these heads, more than anything else, show a powerful African presence in the Americas thousands of years before Columbus and thousands of years before slavery. I say that because I've been arguing for a long time that the worst crime you can commit is to teach a child that their history began with slavery. Now, I've been able to collect now maybe a million, I'll say half million, original photographs, photographs that I've taken myself from museums, tombs, temples around the world, and they tell a powerful story of African achievement, and they say it more powerfully than I could express it in words alone. That's why the pictures are important.
They came before Columbus.
That's the cover of Dr. Van Sertima's book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talk about him for a moment.
Great scholar, great man. We produced some great, great, great scholars, and Ivan was one of the best, and he happened to be my teacher. And I worked with him for 25 years, and I'm his most prolific student. And his thesis was, he called it his thesis, was the African presence in ancient America. Mm-hmm. So Ivan was a remarkable scholar, and I was blessed to spend a lot of quality time with him. Mm-hmm. He mentored me, and I hope that I'm doing a good job carrying on the baton, carrying the torch.
I remember we were required to read his book.
Yeah.
Frank Snowden.
Yeah,
I know
Dr. Snowden's work. Oh, okay.
Dr. Snowden wrote Blacks in Antiquity, right?
Mm-hmm. I know, I have the book.
Yeah, and I remember, man, just not reading it. I remember him saying to us one day, we were saying, we need a pass to get out because we're playing baseball.
Yeah.
And he's very formal, very passionate about what he did. And he said, I'm going to be talking about Nefertiti, and I'm going to be talking about, and he mentioned several other, you know, prominent historians in antiquity, and you guys are going to be playing a little stupid baseball game. And I thought at the time, you know, he's a borderline nut. I have so come to respect him and all of his work and the incredible importance and power of what he was trying to do.
A very different kind of scholar, though. A brilliant scholar. Not everybody appreciates in the African Senate community Frank Martin Snowden Jr. I would have liked to have met him.
Yeah.
Even though if I had met him at that time, I would not have appreciated him like you today.
Mm-hmm.
But he focused more than anybody else on the African image in Greco-Roman civilization.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I have with Dr. Snowden's work is that he was not prepared to say that these same black people that we see in the art of ancient Greece and Rome were the ones who developed ancient Egyptian civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he attacked Shaykhan Tejope, probably the greatest scholar that we've ever produced,
mm-hmm.
because he was not prepared to acknowledge that African people built the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was Shaykhan Tejope's greatest thing, the African roots of ancient Egyptian civilization. So you have different sets of African scholars. And I admire Dr. Snowden now, but probably had I been a student of mm-hmm. his in the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
I would have had a very different feeling towards
him. So there is a theme here, and it hasn't been spoken, but I think that it's a theme that is emerging nonetheless, and that is a theme of what should be the importance of Pan-Africanism.
Yeah.
And I had the good fortune to be able to spend some time with Stokely Carmichael.
Mm-hmm.
You know, up until his dying day, he answered the phone,
ready for the revolution.
Ready for the revolution.
Organize.
So how do we sort of, it's like we are up against a mountain so high and so wide and so deep. Let's talk about how we start to chip away at that mountain.
Well, for one thing, we must be thinkers and doers. It's not enough just to know that we built the pyramids. What you gonna do with it? Mm-hmm. But, see, we have that problem in our community. I do programs and people say, well, Dr. Rashidi, what you're saying is good, but I ain't got time to study. Mm. I'm confronted with the issues that are in our face right now. Mm-hmm. Well, we must be thinkers and doers. Kwame Nkrumah, the ultimate Pan-Africanist, used to say, thought without practice is empty, and action without thought is blind. So I'm a Pan-Africanist, and I'm a historian, but I also realize the importance of community activism. Mm-hmm. For example, unlike some of my colleagues, I think it's very important that we go to the ballot box, mm-hmm. that we sit on juries. I don't know if you can complain about police brutality or the political system if you're not willing to partake in it on some level or another. Mm-hmm. Whereas there are those of us who just completely dismiss that.
Yeah.
So we must be activists, but we must also never lose sight of the importance of history. Mm-hmm. And so I knew Kwame Ture as well. I knew him when he was Stokely Carmichael and then as Kwame Ture. Mm-hmm. And I was a member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party.
Okay.
And I admired him so much. He was our great shining hero, yeah. fantastic orator.
Yeah.
And I guess it had to be about maybe 5 or 6 years before he passed away that he sent me a personal letter from Conakry, Guinea. I still have it. It's on yellow stationery. Mm-hmm. And he said, I remember you when you were a young man, and I'm so proud of what you've become. It's yeah. one of my greatest treasures.
Wow.
And I think he understood that. When I was a member of the study group mm-hmm. that he formed, the first book we studied was Destruction of Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams. Mm-hmm. And that book was so important because here's a man for the first time who not only said to me, as though he was speaking to me personally, that we had a great civilization, but we're able to get it back. You know, a lot of people forget in that book that there's a section called A View from the Bridge.
Yeah.
And there's another section in the back of that book called A Master Plan
yeah.
about how we can regain our power. Mm-hmm. But you can't separate what you did from what you're capable of doing. If you think you never did anything, chances are you'll never do anything. But if you know that you come from a great and mighty people, then you'll aim for the stars.
You know what, because I'm sitting with royalty here, I'm gonna take the liberty to share something. One of the great honors of my life was a friend of mine from Antigua, a guy by the name of Ronan Matthew, calling me in Las Vegas maybe about 12, 15 years ago. I don't know exactly how long it was, but mm-hmm. fussing at me because I hadn't shared the news with him. I didn't know the news that he was talking about. The news was in Kwame Ture's long autobiography that he spent a couple of pages talking about me and some support.
Oh, wonderful.
That he got one of the great, honest to God, one of the great mm-hmm. honors of my life. So look, you started some trouble in my household. I just want to let you know. You sent over some of your information mm-hmm. and it was about the trips
yeah.
that you're taking throughout the year. And Mrs. Newman saw the one about Peru. She's wanted to go to Machu Picchu for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So I'd like for you to share what you see to be the value of those trips. The trouble that you started is I got a couple of puppies and she's talking about trying to go somewhere with you for 17 days.
Yeah.
So talk to me though about that trip. You've got another one where you're going to Tanzania.
Yeah.
You've got another one, where's the third one?
Egypt and then Sudan. Egypt
and then you expanded over into in Sudan. So you don't do that just to go have fun. Talk to me about the purpose of that kind of travel and taking folks with you.
Well, we do try to have a little bit of fun.
Okay.
And, you know, there's plenty of shopping. Mm. But I do African heritage tours. I've been doing them for 20 years now. I'm a historian who gives tours. Mm-hmm. And this year, this June, we do a tour to, it's called, I think, Peru, the Golden Sun Heritage Tour, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
And we visit black communities in Peru.
I was going to say, because yeah. in the brochure, it talked about mm-hmm. the African presence there.
See, a lot of people don't realize there are black communities all over those Andes countries, Colombia, yeah. Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia, et cetera.
Yeah.
So you do that. We're going to spend some time with the black saint, Saint Martin de Porres. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, anybody that goes to Peru needs to go to Cusco. They need to go to Machu Picchu. It's spectacular. So yeah. We do that. Mm-hmm. And then in August, I take a group to Tanzania, Zanzibar.
Yeah.
I was in Zanzibar last May. Fantastic experience. There, we also explore the East African slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go on a game.
So let me ask you, when you say East African, I heard you put emphasis on
yeah.
that. What was that emphasis?
Well, when I went to Zanzibar last year I took a group to Kenya and Ethiopia. And so after the tour was finished, I went on my own to Zanzibar thinking I was going to have a holiday. Zanzibar is an island off the coast of Tanzania.
Mm-hmm.
And the ancestors just seemed to take over. And they seemed like they wanted me to know more about the East African slave trade. And in many ways, it's as horrible, if not more horrible, than the transatlantic slave trade. The difference is the volume of people involved wasn't as great.
Mm-hmm.
But this also tells us that Africa has been impacted by many, many calamities. The East African slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, the Indian Ocean slave trade, the Saharan slave trade. And all of these things impacted Africa and denuded Africa of its population in large measure. And then, of course, in September, I'm going to take an extended October, I'll take an extended tour of Egypt. You can never get enough of Egypt. This time we're going to go to Middle Egypt. Mm-hmm. And since you mentioned Nefertiti, I'm going to take a group for the first time to see the ruined palace of Nefertiti and the tomb of Akhenaten and the tombs of Akhenaten and Nefertiti's daughters and the first known example of martial arts in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never given a tour like that before.
Sounds like you're going to the area where you might bump into Tony Browder.
Well, Tony's focus is mostly Luxor, mm-hmm. and I love Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the work he's doing is phenomenal. But in this part of Egypt, very few people get a chance to go. This is Middle Egypt, mm-hmm. around the place called Minya and Tullamarna.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do a day trip to Alexandria too. And then in November, for those who can handle it, we'll do a trip to Sudan. Not many people go to Sudan. It'll be my second tour there. And in Sudan, you will see the monuments of the land of Kush. There are more than 300 pyramids in Sudan, 120 in Egypt. So I do tours all the time, and yeah. these are the four I'm doing this year.
As you mentioned Sudan, oh uh-huh. my God, I wish we had 3 hours.
Yeah, we but have to do some more.
As you mentioned Sudan, over the last, 15, 20 years, mm-hmm. that you hear about Sudan is war and famine, strife, poverty. Can you give us a snapshot of what's happening in Sudan now?
But you could say those same things about much of Africa, in the sense that that's the image that we get of Africa in general, a war-torn, poverty-stricken continent. As Tony Blair said, the former Prime Minister of England, a scar on the earth. But there's much more to it than that. First of all, Sudan is a huge country. Now you have South Sudan. Yeah. For a long time, Sudan was the biggest country in Africa. I think Algeria and Mali may be slightly bigger now.
Yeah.
But it's a large country, and you do have some problems there. But what we're going to look at are the monuments of ancient Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very safe. And what we have going for ourselves is that a lot of tourists don't go to Sudan. It's very different from Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Egypt tourism is booming now.
Sure.
But Sudan, very, very few people go there. So I would never take a group anywhere that I didn't feel comfortable and I didn't feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of us remember Sudan too, and nobody seems to be talking about it right now, about Darfur. Remember a few years
ago,
Darfur was big in the news.
Absolutely.
But that situation seems to a combination of stabilized a little bit and the fact that the world's attention has moved on, and that's very sad.
We are close to the 15-year war in Rwanda.
Yeah.
You've been there?
I have.
Talk to us about Rwanda.
Rwanda is one of the most beautiful countries in the world, physically and in terms of the people. Rwanda is incredibly beautiful. So I went there and, you know, it was a catastrophe. And people told me when I was there that it was actually worse than it was reported in the news.
The war.
The genocide is called.
Yes.
But now you can't really... I mean, it's very different. For example, you can't say I'm Tutsi or I'm Hutu.
Mm-hmm.
You say I'm Rwandan or I'm African.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, in spite of that terrible catastrophe, there are some positive things that have come out of it.
Yeah.
And now Rwanda is beautiful, man, and I can't wait to go back. Africa is beautiful. And I wish every African in the diaspora, especially as a result of enslavement, could go to Africa at least one time in their life and see it and experience it and smell it and feel it and touch it. It will exercise demons in your mind. Let me tell you a very quick story. I know we're running out of time.
Please, no, you're good.
My early trips to Africa began around 1990, and I went to Egypt, you know, for years.
Yeah.
And I was in love with the monuments. And then I got invited to Southern Africa in 2000, and I did a series of big presentations. Mm. And every presentation I would give, I would start to tell this story in the middle of the talk. I might be talking about anything. Mm. And I tell about these nightmares I've been having. One was, I knew I was in my area somewhere, but I couldn't find my home. I go down this street, this avenue, this boulevard, but I could never find my house. And the other dream was, I would go to visit my family in Los Angeles. I was living in Texas at the time, and they wouldn't welcome me. They'd be very rude to me, laugh at me. And I realized those dreams had a much greater significance than I ever thought about. And that because we were taken from our homes, I think deep in our minds, where do I come from? And where is my home?
Yeah.
And because we were separated from our families, I think there's a fear of rejection and alienation. It might happen again. And who is my family? They don't really want me. And I would say that, and I would come close to just breaking down and crying like a baby in front of thousands of people. And the audience would say, almost to a person, but Renoko, this is your home.
Yeah.
And we are your family. I never had those dreams anymore after that. And I still get emotional when I think about that. It's been almost 20 years now. But the psychological demons that are here as a result of enslavement are buried deep in our psyche. So going to Africa can be a part of the healing process, breaking up this divide. Those Africans don't like you. They don't think you're African. They look down on you. But I don't have those experiences in Africa. So going to Africa is, man, it can really be a healing process. And I wish all of us could do it at least once.
You know, I certainly, as we near the end here, I always attempt to try to leave on a positive note, but I hear you talking about that value, and I understand that. I hear you. The times that we've made travel into Africa, there is something that happens. You feel something extraordinarily special that I don't know if I've ever been able to properly define. You know, when I look at Africans who are emulating the madness and who are buying Korean hair, gluing it on their head. I guess I'd like to take this last 3 minutes that we have to give you a platform to talk to my audience here tonight, which will be in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area, and later, you know, around the world, about what you think is the best way to rediscover who we are.
Well, you started it at the beginning. We have to get comfortable with our African selves. Instead of running from Africa, run to it. I wish I had a silver bullet. I wish I had an easy antidote. But expose yourself as much as possible. Maybe the most important thing I think that we can do as a people, as a global people, is just talk to each other. Sit down with love and patience. You don't have to have the last word. You don't have to be right all the time. Begin to figure out what are the right questions to ask. Look deep within and expose yourself as much as possible to another Africa, not the stereotypical Africa, but the real Africa. Watch the Rock Newman Show. Read as much as you can. Patronize the scholars. Go to the black bookstores. You know, one of the most powerful things that has happened, I think, in a long time, is this movie Black Panther. I had to be dragged kicking and screaming to see that film.
Oh, man, I want to know
but
why you say
that.
That
is a powerful, powerful film because it tapped into this desire that I think all of us have to identify with something greater than ourselves, to see something about Africa and black history that has been denied us. And the people who really made that film a box office success was not people from the conscious community, but ordinary black folk who wanted to identify with something powerful. They never used the N-word. They never used the B-word. Black women were elevated, and it kind of bridged a gap, in a sense, between Africans in the diaspora and those at home.
You know what? And some folks now discourage folks from either seeing it or talking about it not being real. However, what I am hearing you say, that it is an inspiration.
That perception can be more powerful than reality.
Yeah.
And it gives us something to strive for. And it tells us about a deep hunger and longing that I think all of us have deeply, deep inside us.
We're going to try to kidnap you and keep you here in this area.
I would love
so
that.
So that you can,
thank you, my
from
brother.
The nation, from the nation's capital,
appreciate
your
it,
voice can be continue to be heard.
I had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, that wraps us for this evening. For more information on this program or any other program produced by WHUT, go to WHUT.org. Thank you for tuning in. Goodbye and God bless.
This program was produced by WHUT, Howard University Television, and made possible by contributions from viewers like you. Thank you.